We're here to discuss
memory.
Something that everybody wants in their brain because it's very important. So on our panel of experts, we have Dr. Implicit Memory, Dr. Storing and Retrieving Memory, Dr. Sensory Memory, Dr. Explicit Memory, Dr. Working Memory, and Dr. Capacity, Duration, and Contents of Long-Term Memory. That's the one that's going to be our goal, long-term memory. But she's a very important doctor. We are at the University of Mary Washington, live from Dr. Kaufman's class, EDCI 500. Now, some topics in memory that we will discuss will be working, long-term, somatic, procedural, implicit memories. All our doctors are expertise on these subjects. They'll discuss it. Some terms that maybe will be brought up, we're hoping. We think they may be important. Flashbulb. What the heck is that? Maybe we'll hear about it. Visuospatial. Oh, that's one. Sketchpad. Proposition. Oh. And networks. Rehearsals. My goodness, we might be in a play. I don't know. Rehearsals. We're going to see what that's all about. Process of decay. I'm not talking about dead animals here. Oh. Okay? Shoot. All right. Strategies. We've got to have some strategies in our memory. Something to help us. Mnemonics. Peg type. What is going on? Keywords. Chain mnemonics. Learn some information processing ideas. How are we going to process the things that we are learning? How are we going to store them? Hopefully, these are some things that are going to be discussed. How can we use creativity? Elaboration. Rote memorization. Can they be effectively used in our classroom? We're hoping to get some answers from our panel of experts. We hope that we'll discuss maybe some problems that are facing us with memory. It's Alzheimer's. I sure hope you know that. You gotta help us with that one. That's a big one in our society. Amnesia. Mass practiced. Interference. In the audience, we have, just raise your hand, because we're the ones that you have to give us the answers. We're not leaving this room till we get them. We have Stephanie Carmichael present tonight. Linda Jones is here. Elaine Love. Yvette? Is Yvette here? Melissa. Teresa. Suzanne. Joan. Michelle. Sarah. And I'm Annie Spencer. Now, let's get started.
Okay, sensory memory is essentially the gate of memory. Memory's contact with and processing the stimuli of the environment gathered by the five senses. Sensory memory lasts for 1 to 3 seconds, and these memories must be processed within the sensory register for the initial process of memory. The information content resembles sensations of the original stimulus. The sensory register records imagery sensations much like photographs, encodes auditory sensations with sound patterns much like echoes. The other three senses, touch, taste, and smell, are most likely coded as well. Because of the 1 to 3 second duration, we must use critical perception and attention quickly to select and organize the sensory information for further processing. Perception is memory's process of assigning meaning to stimuli. Symbols are interpreted using both physical representations from the world and existing long-term memory. Generally, there are three types of perception within the sensory register. The sensory information becomes more permanent after the perception process and moves on to working memory. The first of these three, perception, is the Gestalt theory. Gestalt is the German word for pattern or whole. This perception organizes sensory information into patterns and wholes instead of bits and pieces of unrelated information, such as phone numbers. You memorize it as three-digit numbers or four-digit numbers. In bottom-up processing, the sensory information is organized into features and components and assembled into meaningful patterns. This perception uses existing knowledge from long-term memory of prototypes, which are the best examples of a category. Top-down processing, the sensory information is processed using existing knowledge from long-term memory of the stimuli that would be encountered in the current situation. Attention is the working memory section of memory, working memory section of memory, focusing upon a stimulus. Automaticity is the ability to perform a task without much mental effort. This comes with practice. When a task becomes automatic, we can focus attention elsewhere while performing and being effective in the automatic task. This leads to multitasking. In conclusion, sensory memory collects stimuli from the five senses, codes the stimuli as sensory information, processes the sensory information through attention and perception, and then moves the information to working memory. All this has to be done in 1 to 3 seconds.
Next.
Hello, I am Dr. Working Memory. Working memory is the memory that you're focusing on at any given moment. It's new information that comes in first by sensory memory. Only a handful of items can be processed in your working memory. This is the reason as to why we might forget to buy an item on our grocery list. The computer is used as a model for working memory, and working memory is just one specific task of the entire memory system. Sensory memory, as Sean just talked about, initially processes the sights, the sounds, and the smells. And this only lasts a few seconds. Information is briefly held there in a sensory store. There, the capacity is large, but the duration is short. For a second or so, a wealth of the data from the sensory memory remains intact, and that memory system selects and organizes information for processing. So then, perception occurs right before working memory. This assigns meaning to a stimulus from physical representations and knowledge. And the example is the Gestalt principle. Okay, in working memory, our mind chooses what to pay attention to. The first step in learning is paying attention, so we must process this information and choose what to recognize or perceive. Working memory is considered the workbench of the memory system. Working memory is an interface where new information is temporarily stored and combined with knowledge from long-term memory to solve problems or to comprehend a lecture. Working memory also equals consciousness. The capacity is limited. And this is why maybe during a lecture it's not possible to retain all the information. Okay, there are three elements to the working memory system. Working memory is made up of the central executive, or the worker. Its activities include innate control and a decision process, reasoning and language comprehension, a transfer of information into long-term memory via rehearsal and recoding. So we might be able to answer your question about that. The second element of working memory is the phonological loop. This is the short-term buffer for information. It recycles items for immediate recall. It helps out the articulatory process, and it executes resources. The visuospatial sketchpad is the third element of the working memory system. This works with visual imagery tasks, and this actually is the system that attempts to organize spatial and visual images. The sketchpad it's the place where images are manipulated, and some aspects of this are looking at a picture or an object and then processing what you can get out of that. The duration of working memory is about 5 to 20 seconds. It's really short, and through rehearsal, you can increase this duration. Working memory helps people not to forget, and we couldn't do without our working memory. Retaining information. This is fragile. Information is easily lost, and it must be rehearsed and kept activated in order to retain it. There are two types of rehearsal. One's maintenance rehearsal, and the other is elaborate rehearsal. And then forgetting. Information can be lost through interference or decay. Interference is when new information gets in the way of old information, and some of that information is lost, but this can also be useful. Forgetting is not always a bad thing. And an example of decay would be if you learn a language and then you don't study it for 3 years or so and you don't practice, that information that you did know could dissipate and eventually disappear altogether. Let's see, working memory, so just as a little overview, the input is very fast, the capacity is limited, duration is brief, about 5 to 20 seconds. Contents include words, images, ideas, and sentences, and the retrieval is immediate.
Hello, I'm Dr. Capacity, Duration, and Contents of Long-Term Memory. What is long-term memory? Long-term memory holds the information that is well-learned and is a permanent storage of knowledge. The capacity for long-term memory is practically unlimited, and as for the duration, once information is securely stored in long-term memory, it can remain there permanently. You may think you have forgot something from long ago, but given the right cues, it should be available for you to remember it. Long-term memory holds the strategies for pulling information from long-term memory into working memory, and that's what you're using at that given moment, the working memory. Contents of long-term memory include declarative, procedural, and conditional knowledge. Declarative knowledge is the verbal information, facts, knowing that something is what it is. Procedural knowledge is demonstrated when we perform a task, knowing how to do something. And the last one, conditional knowledge, is knowing when and why to use the declarative and procedural knowledge. According to Alan Pavio, contents of long-term memory may also include words and images. Psychologists who agree with this point of view believe that information coded both visually and verbally is easiest to learn. So it's best not to use one particular not just use words or just images, but use a combination of both to be the most effective. Most cognitive psychologists distinguish two categories of long-term memory, explicit and implicit, which I think a couple of the other members are going to discuss. That's it. for now.
I'm going to talk a little bit about explicit memories, which are your conscious memories. And they're basically two kinds, semantic and episodic. Your semantic memories are very important for school children in the meaning that they're learning, it's your declarative knowledge. They're learning facts, theories, and concepts so that they will remember things and learn. So this is a lot of what you see in schools. These memories are not tied to a particular experience and are stored as propositions, images, and schemas. Propositions is the smallest unit of knowledge that can be judged true or false, such as Mary has red hair. So if you look at Mary, she has red hair. That would be a small, simple state of fact. Propositions that share information, like two fact statements, can lead to a network, a proposition network. Mary has red hair, Mary has children. So you can put the two things together. Maybe you can do some taking those, thinking maybe Mary's children have red hair. So you can start networking those two small segments into a bigger network. When you work with propositions or network recall, one bit of information can trigger or activate recall of another piece of memory, such as, you know, Mary, using the word Mary might imply that she is a girl. So you start networking different ideas on that. We are not aware of these networks, for they are not part of our conscious memory. It's happening. Images, when you're also talking about semantic memory, there's images which are a representation based on the structure of appearance of information. Some psychologists believe that images are stored as pictures, where others believe we store it in long-term memory and convert it to pictures in our working memory that we learned about when the actually recalling the images to our mind, to the forefront. Faraday and Einstein reported creating images to the reason problem. So Einstein, when he was doing his theory, thinking about when he was learning his theories, what he was doing, he had images in his mind, physical images, so that he was using those images to decide his thoughts. Schemas, which are abstract knowledge of structure that organize vast amounts of information. A schema, which is a single form, is a pattern or a guide for representing an event or skill. If you tell what features are typical of a category, what you expect about an object or a situation. Schemas are generally personal, which you bring to a particular topic might not be the same as what others might think. Having a well-developed schema can help you know or do something. However, it can also lead you down the wrong path in that you might develop a bias in what you have, saying if you have a particular bias, maybe you have a bias towards women, so therefore you may have a bias towards Mary because she's a woman, or different things like that. So you might bring that forefront. Another type of schema is story grammar. This helps students to understand and remember stories. Typical one of this is like reading a murder mystery. You know, there's going to be the murder, there's going to be going out and looking for things, the clues, then there's going to be analyzing the clues, then there's going to be the hunt for the killer, and then there's capture the killer and the book's solved. So you know that there's going to be a story grammar going along. A schema basically representing the typical sequence of an event or an everyday situation is called a script or an event schema. Storing knowledge of the world in schemas and scripts has both advantages and disadvantages when it comes to memory. The next, with episodic memory, or explicit memory, excuse me, is episodic memory, which is basically memory for information tied to a particular place and time, especially information about the events or episodes in your life. It is called an episodic memory. It is about the events you have experienced, so we often can explain an event when it happened. This is an example is using what Annie had mentioned. You have questions about flashbulb memories. Why do we have events that when we think of, such as that would come flashing in the front of your mind, where somebody else it might not be. It's because it's tied to you emotionally, and therefore your adrenaline might be pumping more, your hormones going, and different things like that. So when you store that memory, it has more adrenaline and stuff that is more important to you. So, and also the same way is when you're under stress, that it can bring the memory and the flash forward.
Okay, I'm Dr. Implicit Memory, and these are the unconscious memories. It's also can be called procedural memory, which is a long-term memory which contains skills and how-to procedures. Procedural learning is the retention of motor skills. Learning these skills is a multi-step process. First, you need to develop the know-how. As you practice the skill, your performance improves, and that will lead to your retaining that skill for a long period of time. These skills cannot be well articulated because they are because the knowledge is unconscious. Examples of procedural knowledge are learning how to ride a bike, typing, playing the piano. You can't really explain to someone how to ride a bike. You more have to show them how. An example of why implicit memories are not easily articulated is you can say you can recognize an attractive face or a funny joke, but you cannot tell how you arrived at that conclusion. There's two basic types of implicit memory: repetition priming and the skill learning. Repetition priming is past memories are influencing the way you process your new information, even if you're not aware of it. Implicit memories are stored differently than explicit memories. Implicit memory is an automatic or unconscious form of memory. You remember implicit memories without being aware that you are remembering them. You're always influenced by your past memories, whether you think you are or not. Procedural memory is task-specific. It's related to rules or actions and procedures. After practice, either a little practice or a lot of practice, the task will become automatic. This kind of memory is very instinctive. The difference, this is related to Alzheimer's, the difference between implicit memory and explicit memory is that the implicit memory seems to survive as the explicit memory declines with age or with Alzheimer's.
I'm Dr. Storing and Retrieval. How do we save information permanently? That's a magic question we don't like the answer to. We, like Melody or Dr. Duration said, we have an almost unlimited capacity to learn and remember. The way that we learn information at the time of learning it greatly affects how we can recall it later. One important requirement for storing information in long-term memory is that we integrate new information with things that we already know with prior knowledge. That way we can build an understanding. To do this, we need to use three things. The first is elaboration. Elaboration is adding meaning to new information by connecting it with existing knowledge. And the more we can connect it, the better we'll remember. In other words, we apply our schemas and draw on things that we already know to form an understanding of the new information. Sometimes we have to change our existing information or existing knowledge that we have in the process. Many times we elaborate automatically. We don't even know we're doing it. An example of elaboration can be if you read about a historic figure, say from World War II, that'll activate our existing knowledge about that time period, and it'll take us to other things that we know about that time period. We use the old knowledge to understand the new. When you're teaching, a student's prior knowledge will affect how they learn about something new, so it's important to know something about that. Also, when you're teaching a lesson, it's a good idea to review prerequisites to help students bring to mind the information that they will need to understand for the new understand in the new material. An example of that would be in a math lesson. You may want to review information that builds up to what you want to teach so that that's fresh in their mind and they know what pre-existing information they need to know to go on and learn further about it. The material that is elaborated when first learned will be easier to recall later. Elaboration is a form of rehearsal. It keeps the information active in working memory long enough for us to have the chance to link the new information with existing knowledge that's in long-term memory. Elaboration also builds extra links to existing knowledge. My little drawing. New information. This is information that we already know, and the more links we can build, the easier it will be for us to recall, because we actually have more pathways to recall the information. So the more one bit of information is associated with several bits, the more routes we have to get to the original bit. In other words, you have more priming or retrieval cues to find or recognize the information you're looking for. The more bits of information you connected it to gives you more cues. You might hear a word, and that gives you is a cue that will help you retrieve the information you're seeking. In teaching, the more students elaborate, the more they make that information their own and make their own connections. And that creates a deeper understanding, which helps in retrieval. And as teachers, we can help students elaborate by translating information into their own words. Having them translate information into their own words, they can create examples, they can try to explain it to another person, they can draw or act out what they've learned, and apply the information to new problems, to solve new problems, especially in math. That's what you do. One caution with elaboration: if students develop wrong information when elaborating, that will also be remembered. Organization is our second element of processing that improves learning and storage and long-term memory. Information that is well organized is easier to learn and remember than loose bits and pieces. This is true especially if the information is complex or extensive. Putting information in a structure will help us learn and remember both the general information and any examples that were given. The structure serves as a guide to guide us back to the information when we want to retrieve it. And the third element of processing that affects learning is context. Aspects of physical and emotional context, the places that you're at or the room that you're in, the mood you're in, who's with you. I think the movie had something about it when you were drunk that you could then if you were drunk again, you'd remember what that was. anyway, those things, if you keep those contexts in mind, and you try to duplicate that situation, that helps you remember easier. So if we need to remember something, it will be easier if the current context is the same or similar as to where the original is. That's why simulating your test-taking environment when you're studying is good to do, because you'll feel familiar, I guess, and you'll be in the same context as when you actually have to take it. And they've actually done studies on that where they gave students, taught students in one room and gave them the test in the same room. They did well. And then they also gave them a comparable test in a very different place, and they didn't do so well. And if you can't go back to the setting, obviously trying to picture it in your mind, picture the setting, remember the time of day, your companions, that may help you to reach the information you're looking for. An example of that might be when you lose something. The first thing we try to do is, okay, where was I last when I had it? You know, who was I with? That type of thing, to try to remember where you left that thing that you lost. In 1972, Craik and Lockhart first proposed their levels of processing theory. The theory is that recall of information is based on how deeply it is processed. This relates back to elaboration. They suggested that what determines how long information is remembered is how extensively the information is analyzed and connected, and then the better chance we have to remember it. And an example given was, if somebody looks at a bunch of pictures of dogs and you ask them to try to remember the colors of their coats, that's what they'll remember. But if you give them a question where they have to think deeper, like what dog might chase you when you're out jogging, they're going to analyze the pictures more extensively, and then they'll remember more about the dogs than just the color of their coat. How do we retrieve information? When we need information, we search for it. Sometimes the search is a conscious search. If you come up to somebody that you know, but you can't remember their name, you're searching for that information. Other times, locating and retrieving information is automatic, like solving a common math problem that is so common to you, you don't have to think through the steps, you just do it. That's an area, too, where kids with learning disabilities have trouble, and that's an idea when you're teaching that sometimes you have to break those steps down. They don't always automatically have that processing. The size of the network in long-term memory is huge, but only small parts of it from it are activated at one time. Only the information we are currently thinking about is in working memory. Information retrieved in this network is through spreading activation. When something is active, we are thinking about it closely and associating it with other knowledge. And those other knowledge bits can be triggered by this spreading activation. Activation then can spread throughout the network like this. And an example given is you're thinking you'd like to go for a drive and see the fall leaves. And then you start thinking, oh, I need to rake my leaves. And then you think, I need to get the oil changed. And pretty soon you don't even remember what your original point was. So you can also use spreading activation in reverse and start at the end and try to work back to figure out what your original point was. In long-term memory, the information is still available even when it's not activated and you're not thinking about it. I think Sherry said working memory was a tool bench. Long-term memory is a shelf where everything's stored and you can go to it when you need to. If spreading activation does not lead to the information you're looking for, then we might still come up with the answer through reconstruction, which is a cognitive tool or problem-solving process that makes use of logical cues and other knowledge to construct a reasonable answer by filling in missing parts. Sometimes these reconstructed recollections are not correct, and that's something to be aware of. There was an example of students in Britain who were told a story about American Indians or Native people, and then they were told to retell the story back, but they did it in context to their culture. So it was kind of what they knew. They reconstructed it, but it wasn't exactly the way it was originally told because they related it more from their culture. Reconstructed memory can play a role in eyewitness testimony. Elizabeth Loftus and her colleagues conducted many studies on this, and that goes back to the leading questions when you're questioning a witness. One example was in a car wreck. When they asked for recall on how fast the car was going, one group they asked how fast was the car going when it hit the other car, and the other group they asked how fast was the car going when it smashed into the other car. The group that heard the smash question, of course, said the car was going faster than the group that just heard it hit the other car. So leading questions are important to be aware of when you're asking for information. Information is working memory that is lost before it has a chance to integrate into the network of information in working memory that is lost before it has a chance to integrate into the network of long-term memory disappears, although I guess that's debatable. Some people don't think it ever disappears. Like an example, if you have two people that are in the same situation, in the same place, experience the same thing, you can ask them what they remember, and they probably remember different things. And one person may not remember any part of something that the other person does. So that person didn't integrate it into their long-term memory. Maybe they didn't have enough prior knowledge, or it wasn't important to them. Also, information appears to be lost in long-term memory through time decay and interference. Like the language example that was given, that shows how it can be lost through decay. Sometimes memories then become too weak to be reactivated, and sometimes neurons simply die. Also, newer memories may interfere with old ones. Old memories may also interfere with memory for the new material also. And maybe that's where the term set in your ways comes from, because you're stuck in the old material. You have a hard time bringing in the new material. Even with decay and interference, long-term memory is remarkable. And studies show that students retain a lot of what they learn in school, which is contrary to what a lot of people believe. Teaching strategies that encourage engagement and lead to initial higher learning are associated with longer retention.
The floor is open for a few questions. A question for Dr. Explicit.
Yes.
On the morning of September 11, 2001, most Americans have vivid memories of where they were and what they were doing.
Yes.
Can you tell me what that is and explain it to
me? It could go into a couple different areas. The flashbulb, in the fact that you
saw over and over the pictures of September 11, so into you, your mind, you have those, the Twin Towers, or you have the Pentagon flat embedded into your mind, and so that's put back into your long-term memory.
Dealing with the flashable memory, what are the implications of that for the educational process?
Well, if you make, using flashbulb memory, if you can, when you're teaching a particular subject, if you can make it where it can stick in their mind, such as using, when Dr. Kaufman talks very loud or very excited, you emphasize key points. Such as when you're talking about the American Revolution, maybe you come in dressed as one of those women or one of those men and stay in character the whole time. So the kids are going to have this image of you as they think about that. Their adrenaline, their excitement's going to be going. If you're excited and you're pumping them up and you're getting them into it, then that could be helpful.
I have a question. I think that's the word thing.
Yeah.
When we saw the video, they talked about Erwin Ebbinghaus, and he discussed the forgetting curve in his book. Mm-hmm. So when we cram for a test, we remember it for that second, and we never remember it, you know, it's gone. So why, instead of cramming for a test, why don't we study the information like every year? Like, study it so that we really have it in our head instead of learning so many subjects just a little bit. Maybe we should learn less subjects and really remember them.
I agree with you. That's a good point. I think that maybe some of our subjects should be carried over from year to year, and some of our information should be. Mm-hmm. So maybe that could be written into an SOL as a standard for teachers to follow. Because I do agree with the fact that you are memorizing information just to pass the test sometimes. And I think it's up to the teachers to kind of instill in the students that they need to learn this. This is going to be important information that they need to try to remember for the future. And what they can use as a tool to help them remember over time could maybe be mnemonics, mnemonic devices. They could come up with maybe words that stand for different parts of what they're trying to remember. That might help. Or they can try to come up with these flashbulb memories that'll bring that back to them over the years. But I think it's up to the teachers to constantly reinforce the fact that they need to practice this over time or they're going to forget it. Yes. That's a very good question. Really, blind people, they haven't had the same experiences as us. They can't see the classroom like we see it. They can't see faces. But I'm thinking that maybe in order to understand things that they hear in life, maybe they create their own abstractions in their mind to help themselves remember. I'm sure they have their own technique for organization. Cognitively, they have abilities just like many of us. It's not like they are lower level. So that would be my guess. Oh, can you help? Okay.
Maybe when they do the lesson plan, incorporate something with smells or auditory stuff somehow so that, you know, they can experience the lesson that way, not just visually.
Or maybe through touch.
Touch too.
Maybe they could use that to explain the concept.
After the question for implicit memory, a type of implicit memory is procedural. How can this type of memory play a role in our classrooms?
Well, for procedural memory, it includes how-tos and then like habits. The daily routines, like when the kids come in the morning, they do the same thing every morning. They unpack their backpacks and give you their homework or whatever their routine for the day is. It becomes automatic to them. Eventually it will become automatic. They won't have to really think about it. It'll just be something that they automatically come in and do every day. So I think routine is very important in a classroom.
I do have a question about the flashbulb memories, I guess that would fall for you, Dr. Explicit Memory.
We already made mention to events such as 9/11 or perhaps when JFK was assassinated. But why do those type of memories not fall victim to the process of decay?
When you're under stress or such as things, you're emitting a lot more glucose, and your brain activity is more, in a sense, turned on. You're paying more attention. You're thinking, whereas a standard sitting in a classroom, your mind's wandering, whereas more of a flashbulb moment, your mind is clicked on that event, very in tune. Thank
you. I guess this would go with working memory or perhaps storing and retrieving. Can you recommend ways to combat the serial position effect, prevent it or to minimize it?
The beginning and end.
I think you mentioned it. You were talking about like a shopping list.
Yes.
Now you might forget items in the middle.
Exactly.
Maybe to break it down into chunks.
Exactly.
Maybe you can remember it. Or order that little thing on TV that's much younger.
I always want to order the little things on
TV.
Yeah.
How does creativity influence our ability to teach knowledge that will be remembered? How do you think creativity will influence the knowledge that we teach so they will remember it?
I think she gave a good example with coming to costume, the revolutionary.
Well, you have to present yourself or a topic in a way that drives the memory process, such as so that they'll remember it, in a way to kind of build up the glucose, you know, in the flashbulb. Not quite to that extent, but you want to get them interested, and if they're focusing attention on it, then it'll stick more in the sensory memory. It'll go through the processing perhaps in a way that they'll remember it.
Can I add something to that too? I think that through authentic tasks and problem-based learning, I think that they'll remember things a little better too, just because they're actually participating in the activity they're doing. So when you actually do something, you're more likely to remember.
Teaching all the senses maybe too.
How do we get this into duration in our classroom? From everything that we've talked about today, how can we apply each of these concepts in a meaningful activity to get to the last Dr. Duration?
To secure it in the knowledge base? Well, you want to present it in an interesting manner. You want to arouse them, get their interest. But you also, when you present new information, you want to link it back to something you've already taught them. So, and then you want to, for the upcoming chapter, you want to kind of lead them into that and say, well, this is what we're talking about now. It's going to lead us to this direction next time. And we're going to kind of just relay it all together. So they're constantly thinking and trying to remember everything and see how things interlink to each other. But I think a lot of the times in class, you really need to relate it to what they're interested in. Maybe what they're interested in currently. Like I said before, like, you know, high schools and middle schools are interested in actors and actresses and singers and rappers and all that. Somehow find out information about them and link it to them how, you know, like in science, do some kind of experiments and somehow just relay it to their world so they'll learn it and present it in a manner where it leads to what they're going to learn about next. It might be a lot of repetition, but you want to somehow show them how important it is, why it's important, and how they can use it in the future.
And it sounds like what I'm hearing is that we shouldn't have dry lectures, but we should have some type of engagement to kind of tap into each of these memory pockets and into the brain a little bit to kind of create a sensational. Do I have to dress up in a revolution?
Yes.
Do I have to scream or anything like that to decide the point? Or are there other strategies that possibly have a little quieter I'm not as rambunctious as some people I know. How about...
Could I add one thing before we go?
Absolutely.
My daughter took a field trip to Kenmore Plantation in Fredericksburg. Mm-hmm. I'm sure some of your kids have gone to that, but you're kind of thinking she's in first grade. It's going to be a little history lesson. Are they going to really be interested in it? But they went to the kitchen area where they had, like, the kettle and all the different kinds of older tools, and that really, seeing it visually really jogged their interest. Mm-hmm. And they had the costumes with the old clothes, and they picked out one boy and one girl to get dressed up and all paraphernalia, and they really, really enjoyed that. And I was a little bit surprised, but by seeing it and, you know, interacting and participating, that made a big effect.
Kind of experiencing it.
Yeah.
So experiencing the learning.
Mm-hmm. And seeing how things have changed since then and what we do now.
Just
a tidbit.
Mine was the same as I just thought, like in the classroom, you could have like a little corner that you have specifically for that. So, for instance, if you refer in the lesson to a kettle, then you have the kettle right there and they can actually like see it and touch it.
Mm-hmm.
And if you want to show them how it works and stuff like that.
I would also like to point out that when you discuss bringing creativity within your classroom, I think it has to be comfortable for you.
Mm-hmm.
It's like your classroom management, your setup. It has to work for you. I can't use somebody else's if I'm not comfortable with it. And I think within yourselves, you'll bring about the creativity because it'll feel right to you. Now, Durham, I definitely see you as a person who will dress up. I could see myself dressing up because I do that in kindergarten. Okay, we wear the wacky hats. I'm always with the wacky socks. I mean, because it makes me young and the kids love it. So it works for me, but it may not work for you. So just dive within yourself and feel comfortable with it, and you'll know it's right. And then the kids will feed on that. You'll bring about the imagination, their sense of humor. It's amazing what you'll bring out in children, any age. If they see how comfortable you are at presenting something to them. That's what I want to share.
Mm-hmm. I love that. Well, I think that this panel did a great job.
Absolutely.
Questions were very good, and I think that each of you did an excellent job. And from this, what did you pull out about memory that you can apply to your classroom? That's what I want you to think about.
Great.
Yeah.